WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
The 1980s has been a decade in which clothing prices have gone through the roof and fashion designers have become celebrity billionaires. Nicholas Coleridge has written a new book called The Fashion Conspiracy about the designers, fashion editors, and store buyers who determine how the world dresses. Though he points out the corruption and the ironic contrasts in the world of fashion, Coleridge is himself a member of the conspiracy. He's the editor of the British fashion magazine Harper's and Queen. Last year, he was one of the three Englishmen on the New York International list of best-dressed men in the world. But he says everyone in his office got a kick out of it because they see how he looks when he's not dressed up to attend a fashion show. Coleridge has been writing about fashion for only a few years. He used to be a features writer for The Tatler and a columnist at the London Evening Standard. While on assignment in India in 1985, he accidentally stumbled into the hidden underside of the fashion industry.
I happened to be in Madras in India, of all places, about 4 years ago. I'd been out there to do a bit of war corresponding, and one afternoon I happened to be sitting inside a sauna bath, having a steam bath. And the only other man there was a very, very large Indian. And we started talking, and he said that he made clothes. Would I like to come and see his factory? And I had nothing else to do. So we went in a rickshaw right across Madras, and we arrived at this huge old factory with a kind of old winding staircase. And up we went, and there were about 400 very young Indian girls. They can't have been older than 10, 11, 12. They had those little gold things through their noses, and they were all working on machines, and they were making jumpsuits of a kind of blueberry-coloured jumpsuit. Anyway, I was interested to see it, thought no more of it, until 6 months later I was in New York, and I saw a full-page advertisement in the New York Times for the very jumpsuit that they were making that was going to be in a store. And I thought, how interesting that this little thing that they were making for a couple of rupees, maybe half a dollar in India, was about to be sold for about $50 in a top New York store. And that made me think, what an interesting thing to be able to follow the kind of modern spice route of fashion right from where clothes are made, right through to the sort of glitz and glamour of the stores.
It's interesting to me that seeing the sweatshop in India and contrasting that to the shopping mall somehow became an incentive for you to enter the world of fashion. Because you became a fashion editor yourself.
Well, I wanted to become a fashion commentator because of it, because I thought that the fashion world had become so enormous over the last 10 years. This has been very much the decade of fashion, when it's grown from being a very small and rather unimportant industry into being a really enormous one with shops and stores in every city. And I thought that it was, too, an industry that had a very, very satisfying mixture of very rich people involved in it, all the big fashion editors, the big designers who've made these great labels, and also very poor people involved. So you've got all the pattern cutters, all the people working in the sweatshops, in the factories, and I thought, if I could only find some thrilling way of contrasting the kind of limousine culture and the champagne culture of Paris and Milan and New York with the how it is of the third world, it would be really interesting.
Well, one of the things you did was spend some time in South Korea looking at the different sweatshops there. And you say in the last 3 years, South Korea has become a boom town for clothing sweatshops, for garment sweatshops.
It's become a very terrifying place, as a matter of fact, because there are great mafias of Korean mafia, all of whom are in this making of clothes for the West. And I went round to see all their different factories. Normally, I'm not allowed to go and see these factories, so I hit on the idea that I'd take with me some American sweatshirts, and I'd say to them, how much will you charge me to make copies of these sweatshirts? And after I'd been there about a week, one evening I was lying in my bath, when I heard a rustling of paper being pushed under the hotel bedroom door, and I picked it up, and it was on rice paper, and it said, "You are asking too many questions. You must leave Seoul City." And so, in terror, I went straight to the airport, and I flew back to Paris where I was going. And there again, the fashion collections were going on at that moment in Paris. And there was Jerry Hall with her amazing long legs on the catwalk. And there were all the kind of glitz and glamour. And again, I was tickled and thrilled by that great contrast.
Why do you find it thrilling? I mean, I think I find it kind of depressing myself that people are slaving away for no money at all to make garments that really wealthy people will be parading around in.
I think I mean that it's journalistically thrilling
and very, very
okay. interesting rather than thrilling for them. It has to quickly be said that many of the things that were being made in Korea aren't the actual big label clothes themselves. They're the copies that are going to maybe the second division shops in America and in England and in France and everywhere else. That you have the kind of big labels, the Ralph Laurens, the Calvin Kleins, and then you have all these people all working in the kind of piracy and espionage who are making copies of the big designers and putting them into all the second division stores.
You write about how in the 1980s, designers reached new wealth and took on a new greater status than they ever have before. Does licensing have a lot to do with the immense profits that designers have been able to make in the last decade?
Yes, they've got an enormous amount to do with it. In fact, I would say they were almost wholly responsible.
Why don't you start by explaining what licensing is?
Yes, what it is the designer will do his own collection of clothes, whether he's making coats or jackets or skirts or shoes or whatever. And then, when his name becomes rather famous, he'll sell his name to other people so that a scent will come out with his name, a fragrance, maybe sheets and towels, maybe sunglasses, which he hasn't actually designed himself. He's just allowed his name to go on it to help them sell. But you get some very, very strange examples of licensing. The great French designer Pierre Cardin, for example, now does designer igloos, where it says, which are sold to the Eskimos. And so you get Eskimos sitting inside a plastic igloo that says, designed by Pierre Cardin on the outside. Or else you can buy, in France, you can buy sardines that say sardines and tuna by Pierre Cardin. That's the extraordinary extent of where we've reached by the late 1980s.
Well, I think Pierre Cardin is leading the industry in licensing. He's got 840 different licensees.
It's quite incredible. But so what's really happened is that these designers have made the 1980s the fashion decade. In the 1950s, I guess it was cars, and in the 60s, it was rock music, in the 70s, it was computers. And I think when you look back on the 80s in perhaps 100 years' time, everyone's going to say that was the year that the fashion designers really took over.
I think a lot of people assume that if you're buying, designer salad dressing or something, that there's going to be quite a big markup only because it bears the name of the designer on it, not because of something inherent in the product itself. Is that usually true?
Yes, it's a true fact. You are, of course, paying a great deal for the name. I suppose that people could quite reasonably say, why on earth do people want to pay money for a name? The reason, of course, is that people are quite insecure. And I think there's a lot of women in the world who think that if it has a label saying Claude Montana on the back, then it's better than a jacket that doesn't say Claude Montana on the back.
I'll tell you something that I know bothers me, that I'm sure bothers a lot of other people. If you want to buy if you want to buy a garment that has a designer's name sewn on it, I mean, you feel really silly parading around their name. Who wants their name on your body?
I agree.
Why have the designers gotten into labeling their clothes as prominently as they have?
I think for the simple reason that some people aren't as discriminating as you are, and they actually like to have the name of the designer. If you walk along the streets of the world anywhere now, I don't mind whether you're in Rio or whether you're in Tokyo, whether you're in Detroit, whether you're in Philadelphia, you see the word Hugo Boss written across people's T-shirts at the moment. Hundreds and hundreds of thousands of them are being sold. It's very hard, really, to explain that great need people have to be walking advertising agencies for big designers.
Well, a really bad effect it's had is that even if you're not buying designer clothes, but say like Joe Schmo is designing the clothes, there'll be a big Joe Schmo on your clothes.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's really filtered down. So it's starting to affect us all. You write about fashion colonialism, about how every fashion capital has the same boutiques with the same garments in them, for the same, in the same shopping bags.
It's quite extraordinary.
Has it always been that way, though?
No, it hasn't always been that way. It's all happened in the last 10 years. Somebody said to me as a joke that if a blind man came out into the main shopping street in any of the big cities of the world now, he could actually tell as he walked along the street, running his hand across the store fronts, which shops he was going past, because they're all the same. You get the marbleized Chanel shop, then you get the Yoji Yamamoto shop that's slightly concrete-y, then you'll get the very, very chrome one that's probably Yves Saint Laurent, then you get the wood one, which is Ralph Lauren, and they are everywhere. The women of the world all wish to dress the same at the top end of the designer market.
My guest is Nicholas Coleridge, the author of the new book, The Fashion Conspiracy. He's also the editor of a fashion magazine in England, Harper's and Queen. You've interviewed most of the big-name designers as part of the research for your book. And I have to tell you that as a woman, I have frequently found myself really resenting a certain type of male designer. And I've interviewed some people like this as well, and I find that their definitions of femininity are sometimes really quite disturbing. And these are the men who define, at least for a certain part of the population, what femininity looks like.
I very much agree with you. It's one of the great mysteries about why it is that so many, perhaps 95% of the world's famous designers, are men. I think that it's a very dangerous thing to be a designer for a long time because they surround themselves with so many toadies and gophers and assistants, all of whom are so praising to them, that a terrible egotistical malaise settles on them and the level of paranoia grows and grows and grows. And I think that whenever one interviews designers, they tend to talk in increasingly similar terms about women because they want to encapsulate all women in their description. And so they'll say, my woman is contemporary and yet she is classic. My woman is fresh and yet she is mature. My woman is intelligent and yet she is brave enough to be trivial. Those kind of phrases just grow and grow and grow. And you can see them everywhere. You can read them in Italy. Valentino says that. Bill Blass says that. Everybody says that.
My favorites are the kind of like, you know, my woman is strong, independent, gets on in a man's world, but hasn't lost that special touch of femininity. I mean, what does that mean? I could never figure out what does that mean. Let me quote exactly something that Oscar de la Renta said to you. He said, I always like to think of women as being very feminine, possibly because I am Latin. I like to think of the woman exercising her priority, dressing with care to attract and flatter the man. I think that women, most women, want to be dressed like women. So I try to make pretty clothes for them. I try to tempt them so that they can tempt the man.
I love it. Oscar de la Renta is terribly amusing example of all this kind of thing. The only thing Oscar de la Renta doesn't have is he doesn't have the power woman phrase. That's the only thing that's missing from his great speech about femininity. Normally you would expect to find the line, but my woman isn't afraid to earn her own living, to make her own life, to have her own statements. It's a curious vocabulary of fashion, and it was so much fun to try and decode it.
Aren't you a part of this male part of the fashion conspiracy, editing a fashion magazine and being a man editing stuff about women's fashion?
Yeah, I think I probably am to some extent a fellow traveller in the fashion world. When I first started writing this book, I was no such thing. But I've ended up with two rather kind of different views of fashion. On the first hand, I think that the fashion industry is much, much, much more important than I realised it was when I started writing the book. I don't think people who work outside fashion have any idea how enormous it's become and how powerful it's become, and how if those big fashion labels were quoted on the Wall Street or on the London stock market, they'd be right up there with sort of AT&T and things virtually. On the other hand, I think that to work in fashion, to stay in fashion for too long, is a very, very dangerous thing for people. And I would say to anybody, if you stay in longer than 15 years, you're very, very dangerous. You're being far too brave.
You haven't told me yet, I don't think, what you like about the fashion world and what keeps you in.
Oh, I like lots of things about the fashion world. I like it. I do like the glamour of it. I like the creativity. I like the way that people are always competing against each other. And I like the way that fashion changes so much. Fashion, compare it with, say, I don't know, the food business or newspapers or insurance. Fashion just has to change all the time. So I love all that kind of fresh side of it. I love all the hype in a way. I think it's fun. I think some very clever and creative people are working in fashion at the moment. And once you get behind the kind of wall of dumbness and stupidity that they put up around themselves, they're really very nice.
I want to talk more with you, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Nicholas Coleridge, the author of the new book, The Fashion Conspiracy. He's also the editor of the British fashion magazine, Harper's and Queen. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Nicholas Coleridge. We're talking about the subject of his new book, The Fashion Conspiracy. Now, part of this fashion conspiracy, the way you've defined it, includes the editors of fashion magazines, of which you are one. Let's talk a little bit about what happens in the world of fashion magazines. You say that, for instance, that fashion magazines sometimes show fashions that the editors think aren't very attractive, but they show them in a wonderful light because the designers who make these fashions are also the advertisers in the magazine.
Well, there is always an area in a fashion magazine of sort of trading off, and one, as editor-in-chief, one has to be very careful to make sure it doesn't become all-overriding. The French and the Italians have been terribly stupid, in my opinion, about this, and so at the beginning of each season now, a terrible corruption has crept in where they will say, we're going to photograph 20 of your new frocks, and in return, we want 20 colour advertisements from you. That's a very dangerous thing because it begins to take away from the fashion editor their rapport with the reader, so that they're no longer choosing clothes for the readers, they're choosing them for the money men. So far, the American and English magazines have managed to prevent it creeping in too much, but one's beginning to see signs of it. Of course, fashion magazines do lots of very naughty things as well. We're endlessly pinning up clothes that are too loose behind to make them look tighter or more sexy. We're endlessly shortening skirts to make them look more attractive to buy. In certain cases, we will actually ask designers to very slightly amend their designs to make them more fashionable so they're different from the ones in the store. There are an awful lot of faintly disgraceful things, but all I can say in our defence is that we're doing them to sort of please people, I mean to please the reader, to make the picture look better and more glamorous.
What about the department stores? You include department store buyers as part of what you call the fashion conspiracy.
The department store buyers are really important because when the designer shows their clothes on the runway and there's all that hoopla and everybody comes to see it, it's really the store buyers who decide what's actually going to be for sale. They can edit out two-thirds of the things that they see and they can think, you know, nobody in Milwaukee's going to buy a Christian Lacroix leopard skin top hat. And so that's the end of that. The store buyers also decide what's going to be, you know, when you go into the store, what's going to be in the front? Is it going to be the little Ralph Lauren boutique or is it going to be the Gianfranco Ferri rack of ties? The store buyers are very important, but they're very jealous always of the fashion editors. It's always rather amusing. There's a sort of rivalry between the two because at the big stores, the fashion editors get given the power seats. If you go to a fashion show, in the front row, there you see Harper's Bazaar and Vogue and Women's Wear Daily. They're all at the front. And then on the other side, but in a slightly less good place, you get the big store buyers from Bloomingdale's and Saks and places like that. And they're all sort of jealous because they're thinking, we've got more power than the editors, so why are the editors getting a better view? It's all part of the snobbery and status consciousness of fashion.
You've mentioned some of the ways that you think fashion editors, fashion magazine editors, sometimes compromise their judgments. What about the department store buyers? Are there any compromises there?
Oh, good heavens, yes, because the store will tend to have a relationship with the designer so that maybe for the last 10 years they've always bought Pierre Cardin or Lanvin or something, and they sort of have an agreement about how many clothes they're going to buy and where the clothes are going to go. There's an awful lot of sort of demarcation. And if you're a great big Italian designer like Giorgio Armani, you would get so angry if your clothes are suddenly put in the back of the store when you're used to being in the front that you maybe would, I don't know, reduce your, you know, put, make your clothes more expensive or put every kind of pressure on the store.
Who do you think is most responsible, the designers, the buyers, or the magazine editors, or some other group, in determining what the taste, what the trend is going to be in a season?
Well, I think one of the key things in the fashion conspiracy are those three different groups are the three points of a triangle, and there's always tension between the three, but and I would say they probably all have slightly equal power. We saw an interesting demonstration of it not long ago, in which, with the miniskirt, which flunked, it didn't work anywhere around the world. The magazines pushed that miniskirt, they wanted the miniskirt to work, and the store buyers on the whole didn't. And I think we can say the store buyers won that round.
Well, but I think we could also say that the women won that round, because I think a lot of women were really resistant to it, and they're the people who are missing from that triangle. The power triangle is the women who have to wear the clothes.
Of course, when the women who buy the clothes, of course, have, you know, the major vote. It's they in the end who are going to be there on polling day and decide which of the designers is going to win. But the store buyers didn't put really enough of those miniskirts into the shops. They never really believed in those miniskirts, and so they didn't sell them or promote them in the same way that the designers wanted them to do. And so you're of course quite right. It's your average person who has the final say. But I sometimes think in the fashion world that the ordinary person is very much at the bottom of the pile.
Well, looked upon with contempt. Is that what you mean?
I wouldn't say contempt, but I wouldn't say they were considered all that much. For example, none of the big 100 designers really like designing for big women. They think it's rather unchic to be making the bigger sizes. They love to be designing for thin models. And that's why some of the greatest designers in the world don't have an overweight women's line. You may think it mad. Why don't they, you think to yourself? But they just don't want to be part of that world.
Your book ends at a dry cleaner's in Kuwait, which you call the elephant's graveyard for fashion. Would you explain?
Yes, it's such an extraordinary thing. A lot of the world's most expensive couture clothes are bought by Arab women living in maybe Dubai or Kuwait or Saudi Arabia. They love to order expensive French couture, and they see it on these videos they get sent, and they love to buy it. But they don't want to wear it very often. Maybe they wear it once, they wear it twice, and then the next season comes along, they get the fashion magazines, they get very bored of it. So they send their clothes to these dry cleaners, and then they never trouble to go and collect it. And I went into one of these dry cleaners in Kuwait, and if you can imagine a really, really large underground room, and as far as the eye can see, there were just rails and rails and rails of abandoned clothing, and they were Chanel, they were Saint Laurent, they were all the big labels hanging there. And I said to the man who ran this dry cleaners, what do you do with them? And he said, nothing. They just have to stay there. They can't throw them away because the people who they belong to are married to such powerful people, and places like Saudi Arabia are run in such a sort of amazing way by these sheikhs. They put such terror into the hearts of dry cleaner owners that they're just there, these abandoned clothes. And I thought it gave an amazing perspective to fashion, and in a way was the kind of other end of the journey from the sweatshops where they start, and then the hype in the middle, and the designers in the middle, and then ending at the other end of this equation in this dry cleaner in the middle of nowhere.
I guess they could do pretty well if they had a sale, huh? But they're not going to.
Would be just great to get one's hand on all those dry cleaning tickets.
So here comes the inevitable question. What kind of dresser are you?
I'm trying to describe what I'm wearing as I sit here. I tend to wear rather ordinary English suits, which I just have made in a tailor close to my office. But I've got a taste for rather jazzy ties, which rather grew as I was doing the book. As I travelled around the place, I always thought, oh, I'll buy a tie in Milan because I'm here and I'm coming back to Milan. I'll buy another tie. So I've ended up with this rather vulgar collection of very flashy ties. I've got one on at the moment that's bright red with very big blue circles all over it. And I'm embarrassed to say it's got on the back of it a very prominent label.
Oh, uh-huh. Well, at least it's not on the front, right? The kind of fashion that we have been talking about is really fashion designed for women, mostly for women with a lot of money. In the world of couture, for instance, you might have to go back 16 times for a fitting, and you might be traveling to another country for these fittings. So it's not only the price of the garment, but the expenses of going to get it fitted. Is there any equivalent in the world of men?
No, frankly, there isn't. A book about men's fashion wouldn't have anything like as much oomph, because men don't change their clothes nearly as often. They don't replace their clothes or buy new clothes nearly as often. And although from time to time now we're reading that there has been a great revolution in menswear, it's but a small thing compared with women. It was great fun in this book to interview all those very flashy Manhattan women who spend maybe $300,000 a year on their clothes. Several of them told me that their husbands maybe spent $1,500 a year on their clothes. It's not really a comparison at all. I'm rather sorry on the whole for the men in these who are married to these women, because I reckon they just have to work very, very, very hard to pay their wives' dress bills.
Why do you think it is that in a decade where things have become a little more equal between men and women, that the women's fashion industry is still more expensive, more flamboyant, more exploitative in many ways than the men's is?
It's difficult to explain because there has been a kind of chasm in fashion in that there are designers, particularly women, I'm thinking of Norma Kamali and Donna Karan and people, who are designing extremely wearable and sensible clothes for women, as indeed do people like Oscar de la Renta in their main lines. But this allure for couture has grown and grown and grown in the last 6 or 7 years, I suppose out of the great sort of part of maybe Nancy Reagan is responsible in some way, and in the great growth of glitzy, moneyed America and glitzy, moneyed Europe. There's a great market of rich women who just wish to dress in a eye-catching and rather lush way.
All clothing prices seem to have just skyrocketed in the past few years, and I'm not talking about couture, I'm talking about just any garment you pick up in a department store. Do you have any guesses what's responsible for that?
Yes, I think that it's because the marketing of clothes has grown so much. If you think back about 5 years and you opened magazines or newspapers, newspapers had much, much less fashion advertising and less fashion coverage. Magazines were much thinner than they are today. There's been so much money invested in getting these labels to be terribly well known that the cost has inevitably had to be passed on to the people who are paying and buying these things.
So how long are you going to stay in the fashion world yourself?
Well, you see, I'm in a very lucky position because the magazine that I edit in England is only 45% fashion and it's 50% articles. And so I can drift in and out depending whether I feel in a fashion mood. I can spend time in the fashion room. And if I feel like being interested in travel or politics or something, I can go there. But it's a very gripping industry. And I think anyone who's interested in fashion and gets pulled into it finds it jolly hard to escape. It's a sort of, it's a chasm, it's a pit, it's a magnet. And
hey, you sound like you're in trouble.
Maybe I'll never be able to escape from it. It's just too interesting.
Thank you so much for sharing some of your observations with us. Thank you very much.
I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Nicholas Coleridge has been my guest. His new book is called The Fashion Conspiracy. It's published by Harper & Row. And he's also the editor of the British magazine Harper's & Queen. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.